Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Dr. Arjun Makhijani. Arjun is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. A recognized authority on energy issues, Dr. Makhijani is the author and co-author of numerous reports and books on energy and environmental related issues. He was the principal author of the first study of the energy efficiency potential of the US economy, published in 1971. Recently, he co-authored Carbon-Free and Nuclear-Free, a roadmap for US energy policy, published in 2007. He's the recipient of many awards, and in 2007, he was elected a Fellow of the American Physical Society. He has many published articles in journals such as the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, the Progressive, as well as in newspapers including the Washington Post. Dr. Makhijani has served as a consultant on energy issues to the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Edison Electric Institute, the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, and several agencies of the United Nations. Dr. Arjun Makhijani, welcome again to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you so much, Helen.
Arjun, tell us about your basic training in physics. Are you a plasma physicist? I get it wrong.
No, that's quite right. I did my undergraduate in India in electrical engineering. So that was power, electricity, you know, consumption, production, transmission, distribution, all that.
Yeah.
Then I did my master's in also. All my degrees are from electrical engineering department, but they are very different things. Upper atmospheric, ionospheric physics, basically. And then my doctorate is in plasma physics applied to nuclear fusion.
What is plasma physics?
Plasma physics is not the plasma that doctors like you deal with.
Yeah, I thought it might be.
Blood plasma.
Yes.
Plasma that physicists deal with are ionized gases. So, for fusion, like in the interior of the sun, for example, temperatures are so high that the electrons that circle the nucleus of the atom get stripped off. And so you get basically free electrons, which are negatively charged, and free positive ions, which are positively charged. And so you get basically a gas at high temperature that consists of charged particles. So in addition to gases like air moving as neutral particles mechanically bumping into each other, you have electrical forces, and they dominate.
And what do they do? Do they produce heat or?
Well, eventually, yes. Everything gets thermalized. And in fusion, you try to make the gas very, very, very hot, like the interior of the sun, or hotter.
Yeah.
Of course, it can't be in contact with anything material because it would melt the material. So you try to contain this hot gas in a magnetic field. But it's very unstable and very difficult. And the reason you make it hot is you try to get these ions of hydrogen or tritium and deuterium to bump into each other frequently enough that they will fuse and then create energy. So that's very, very hard to do. And no one has yet produced a controlled, consistent, sustained net energy from fusion. Of course, we've produced thermonuclear bombs from fusion.
Yeah, the hydrogen bomb.
The hydrogen bomb, popularly known.
Well, I like to quote Einstein. The significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were when we created them. And I feel that fusion and all this very high-tech stuff, which I think fascinates a lot of men, shall I say, is at the same level as that which Einstein was talking about, whereas you, Arjun, created this wonderful document called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free. Would you like to explain to us what that document says? It was published in 2007. What did you find when you did the research for that, Arjun?
Well, of course, I should say before that it was inspired by you and S. David Freeman and that conference that you had in 2006. You know, David Freeman made the speech saying we should really go to renewable energy and 100%, and I didn't think it was economically feasible, but I hadn't really looked.
Tell people who David Freeman is.
David Freeman is the father of energy policy in the United States. He was worrying about oil imports when he worked in the White House in the 1960s, and then started the energy policy project of the Ford Foundation. I worked for him then in the 1970s. He was chairman of the Tennessee Valley Authority and has run public utilities much of his professional life. He's a pragmatic visionary. He's an inspiring person to me. Not just because he's a visionary, but because he's also practical. And he can change his mind about things when he sees the reality on the wall. And like a lot of people who are, you know, who occupy positions of authority and power, and David certainly has done that. And when I began to look at the feasibility, economic feasibility, we always know that, you know, you can have solar cells and attach a lot of batteries to it, and then you can generate electricity for 24 hours out of between the direct sunshine and the battery stored electricity. But that's very expensive, and that's my reaction was that it may not be practical. But when I actually looked at the practical world of that we live in, there's a technological revolution going on. For example, there are 30-odd thousand houses that have been built in the last few years in Germany according to what are called passive building standards. This, you know, this requires knowing where south is, insulating the house properly so that, you know, you put the windows south facing in the northern hemisphere so that you get the you pick up the heat in the summer, and then you have awnings and shade the windows in the summer, reducing air conditioning requirements. This eliminates 70% of the energy footprint of a house compared to an ordinary new house, which is more efficient than many existing buildings. And then the rest of the 30% is very simple to supply with renewable energy. Now, you take Hanover House in New Hampshire. It doesn't have air conditioning, but it is a well-built house. It wasn't expensive. It cost about $115 a square foot to build, which is, just for reference, the cheapest house I think you can build is probably $70 a square foot. And custom houses would be $300, $400, $500 a square foot, or even more, I mean, if you really want a very, very fancy house. So $100-and-odd is a pretty modestly priced house. But this one is well insulated. It has efficient appliances. It has south-facing windows and a large solar water heater. Nothing high-tech. And a 1,000-gallon tank buried underground to store the hot water. And in Hanover House, almost all of the heating and hot water comes from circulating the hot water under the floor. And in the radiant heat heating. And then the net electricity consumption is only 5,000 kilowatt hours electrical for everything, appliances, supplementary heating, supplemental hot water. That's only 15% of the energy footprint of a typical house in the United States.
Well, why the hell aren't architects designing these houses, number one? Why the hell are not laws written so that every blasted house in the United States is a passive solar house such as the one you've just described, Arjun? You can sense my frustration that here are the answers that we have to our energy problems, and no one's doing a goddamn thing about it. And
yes.
What are we going to do with these stupid politicians?
I have a lot of hope. I don't have a lot of hope in Washington. Everybody can see that Washington is broken.
It's a morass.
A fact-based discussion in Washington on anything is very difficult. And climate has been among the more difficult of these difficult issues. Even though Alan Greenspan said the war in Iraq is largely about oil and we've spent directly about $1 trillion over there. And then indirectly it's going to be trillions more.
Three trillion in total, according to Stiglitz.
Yeah. So we cannot get even a sensible discussion about going to, say, electrical transportation or high-speed rail between major cities and so on. There is a discussion, but we can't seem to get it done. Now, the reason I have hope is two things. One, California has a 33% renewable portfolio standard. That is, they want to generate 33% of their electricity from renewables, solar, wind, and so on, by 2020. That's not far away. That's pretty close.
Mm.
California is part of the Western grid in the United States, and more than half the people in the Western grid live in California. So California is at least going to transform the Western grid if they stick with it.
Mm.
And it's a very big weight in the American economy. It's one of the biggest economies in the world, actually. I forget whether it's 7th or 8th or something like that. Now, Germany, of course, is even bigger than California. California has 35 or 40 million people, and Germany has about 80 million. Also a very advanced economy. And Germany was already headed toward a mainly renewable, non-nuclear electricity system. But after the Fukushima disaster, they've explicitly decided to get rid of nuclear on a fast timetable in the next 11 years. Now, you can argue whether they will achieve it or not. And I think that's irrelevant. If they miss it by a year or two, it doesn't matter. I think so there's a lot of sort of hot air about, whether the Germans are doing a good thing or not. I think they're doing a very good thing.
Oh, they're doing a brilliant thing, a pioneering thing.
You're pioneering, brilliant from that point of view, but a very good thing by setting an ambitious timetable.
Yeah.
Because they're going to transform their technological structure. Siemens, their, energy company, one of their big energy companies, already a leader in offshore wind turbines. By setting an ambitious timetable, they are going to have, an immense lead in offshore wind technology. Just to talk about one thing, they're going to have an immense lead in how to actually practically do smart grids. And I actually think they have a pretty good shot at succeeding. And they'll become a bigger export powerhouse than they already are.
And it's going to do their economy great good. I mean, the GDP is going to go up. Their employment rate will go up. Why on earth? Well, America's just...
California has building standards.
Yeah.
Washington is broken. This country, has not been able to have a good energy policy debate since 1980.
Well, why?
Since Ronald Reagan took down the solar water.
So what are the dynamics in Washington, God help us, which prevent decent, pragmatic, sensible solutions to the energy debate? What are the obstacles? What is holding it back? Be precise, Arjun.
Well, there's the common explanation, which is partly true. You've got the nuclear lobby, which is well-financed, and you've got the fossil fuel lobbies, which are well-financed. And everybody saw we had a disaster last year in the Gulf of Mexico. And then there are also a lot of jobs tied up in the fossil fuel industry. So
deep-pocketed
folks.
A lot of money, yep.
It's the economy of Louisiana, coastal Louisiana, which was suffering. And there was a lot of pressure, not only from oil companies, Of course, oil companies ride that popular pressure and they stoke it up and they give, you know, everybody knows that the campaign contributions make a lot of difference. And there isn't the smart grid business by comparison to the oil business is not even a fraction of one. It's a fraction of 1%.
Describe what the smart grid is, because I don't think... Describe what a smart grid is, Arjun Makhijani. Yeah. So I don't think people know.
Yeah, let me tell you what the dumb grid is. Now, I say
the
that with due respect, because we have a grid that works reasonably well in the United States, and I'm sure you do in Australia as well. And by which I mean when you flip the switch, the lights come on, and overall the bills are pretty reasonable compared to the quality of the supply we're getting. But the reason it's a dumb grid is this. Almost no information in the system. So the information between exchange between consumers and producers is only through the switch. You flip it on, it comes on. You flip it off, it goes off.
And no one knows where their electricity is generated, because I ask them all over the states, where do you get your electricity? And their eyes roll back in their head. They have no idea.
It's part of the malaise of living in cities. You know, we think food grows in the grocery store and electricity comes out of the outlet, and it's sort of part of why we're not really in touch with how we're affecting the planet. But be that as it may, the total amount of information, the on-off information between the consumer and the producer of electricity in the whole United States can be fit on a $10 or $15 flash drive. That's it. Now, what would a smart grid do? Now, your frost-free refrigerator has a defrost cycle. It only comes on once in a while when a thin layer of ice might build up, and there's a little heater in there, and the heater comes on. Of course, the heater uses electricity. Now, do you care or do you know when the heater comes on to defrost your refrigerator? I don't, and I'm an energy guy. If your refrigerator was a smart refrigerator, and the grid was a smart grid with wind and solar, when there was plenty of wind and solar energy, the defrost cycle would work, and when there wasn't enough, the defrost cycle would get a little delayed. Nobody would know the difference. Now, your dishwasher could be connected to the grid in a similar way. A smart dishwasher would come on when there was plenty of renewable energy, or your clothes washer. Now, if you had a party and wanted to wash your dishes immediately after, you could override it, but you would pay more. So these are just a few examples. If we went to electrical transportation, you could use the batteries as reserve power for the grid. You could have new businesses in which you could sign up with a business and say, okay, I've got an electric car, I've got a dishwasher, I've got a clothes washer, and so on, and if I've got an air conditioner, and if you want to increase the temperature in my house by 1 degree at will and sell that capacity to the utility, I'll agree to do it, provided you give me, I don't know, $10 a month, $20 a month, or something like that. And this kind of system would actually be much cheaper, much more efficient, require fewer resources, and be very amenable with a solar photovoltaic on your rooftop and a local storage battery at the utility substation, as well as wind and solar energy. Now, so the smart grid is being developed. It will be developed in California. It will be developed in Germany. And the Institute of Electronic and Electrical Engineers is developing standards. Because if you're going to have this communication, you need communications protocol. Otherwise, everybody will go and make their own type of machine. And it's like going to the hardware store and having non-standard screws. It would not work. So we're in the beginning stages of this, but I'm convinced this is going to happen despite Washington.
I'm interviewing Dr. Arjun Makhijani, the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Arjun, I've got a question. Someone once said to me that the amount of energy reaching a light bulb, or no, the amount of light you get from a light bulb compared to the electricity generated at the power station and losing energy along the grid, losing energy as heat in the light bulb and the like, you only get about, I can't remember, but it was about 18% of the energy as light from your bulb compared to what was generated originally in a reactor or in an electricity generating station. Can you walk us through that, how much energy is lost along the way? Because it was amazing.
Yeah, we live in a very inefficient world. We think we are high tech, but we're not. Actually, you're being a technological optimist with your numbers. Let me walk you through. You have a unit of nuclear energy or a unit of a lump of coal.
Right.
And when you burn the coal or fission the uranium atom, you get a certain amount of heat. Two-thirds of that heat goes as waste heat at the power plant, as you know, with the, in the condenser water. So only one unit out of three out of burning coal or fissioning uranium comes out as electricity.
Right.
Out of that one unit, by the, you lose about 10% of that in transmission, 8% in transmission and distribution. But we can ignore that. That's a relatively small thing. You put that electricity in your light bulb, your old-fashioned light bulb, the incandescent bulb. About 3% or 4% of that electricity comes out as visible light, and 96 or 97% is heat. And so based on the electricity, your efficiency is about 3 or 4%.
Huh.
If you have your modern efficient bulbs, you know, the compact fluorescents, which have become symbols of efficiency, they're only about 10 or 12% efficient in terms of the electricity. Now,
so,
in terms of the fuel, you know, the incandescent bulb is about 1% efficient.
Gee.
And the compact fluorescent is about 4% efficient.
Gee, that's amazing, isn't it?
It's pretty pathetic.
1%.
That is because we have not invested in the science of the thing. And now that is changing. I think it started changing in 1973 when people suddenly realized the lifeline of the West runs through the Persian Gulf, and that wasn't really a very good thing. Dave Freeman, that's why I say he's a visionary and a really extraordinary person, because he was worrying about that in the 1960s. Actually, President Truman's Commission on Materials and Energy, a strategic national security commission, said so in 1952. We're going to have an oil-related security problem in about 20 years.
But we don't generate. We don't generate electricity from oil anyway.
Well, in the United States, it was about 8 or 10%. Now it is negligible, a couple of percent.
Well,
electricity comes from nuclear coal, gas. Those are the main
things. If you have a solar collector on your roof, solar electricity.
I do. I have one.
All right. So you have one. So let's translate the solar electricity you generate on your house to your light bulb. How efficient? What's the efficiency of that compared to 1% or 2% from a distant power station?
Well, the solar electricity, the solar cell is only about 15% efficient in terms of the sunlight that shines on it.
Yeah.
But you don't pay anything for sunlight, so it doesn't really matter.
That's right.
You pay for the solar panels, of course. So, but the efficiency of the bulb is the same. You know, it's the same light bulb. It's just a different source of electricity. So the numbers pretty much stay the same, except you don't have the waste heat at the power plant.
And you don't have the transmission waste.
You save that 8 or 10% on transmission. But remember, it isn't actually as simple as that, because I don't generate electricity for 24 hours a day, right? I only generate electricity on my roof when the sun is shining, and it varies from hour to hour and even minute to minute sometimes, depending on the day.
Mm.
And certainly by the seasons. So I actually put surplus energy into the grid when it's very sunny, and like April or May, when I'm not consuming a lot of electricity. And then I get electricity back from the grid. So it doesn't mean that I don't have distribution losses, which are most of the losses actually in the grid. It's not in transmission. It's in distribution. It's in the local wires because they're low voltage wires. So I actually use the distribution system. And this is a problem currently with the way we're doing solar energy. Everybody wants the subsidies to do solar, but nobody really wants to pay for the distribution system that's necessary to make it work. And we have to start doing that.
I don't understand. I mean, you just sell it back to the grid, and then when you need it, you take it from the grid. When the sun isn't shining, well, what are you? What do people need to pay for?
You've got to pay for the wires.
What, from your solar collector?
Yeah, because my solar collector needs the utility's wires to be able for the utility to be able to take it from me and buy it from me and sell it to somebody else.
So did you pay for the wires?
So if I don't pay for the wires, of course the utility will go bust eventually.
I think we all should be prepared to pay more to save the planet. I don't understand why it all boils down to economic arguments instead of moral, altruistic, philosophical arguments that we're going to spend some money to save the Earth. I mean, where are we at?
I don't think they're in conflict, Helen. You know, I mean, that was sort of the big message of my book, is that if we have the right policies, and I know you were very happy when it came out. You were on my advisory board, as was Dave. And the central message is we can pay more per kilowatt hour for electricity.
Yeah.
We make our homes more efficient.
Yeah.
And our total bills will not go up.
Yeah.
We just pay for different things. You pay a little bit more for having an efficient home and more insulation and better windows and all that. And you consume less energy and you're just as comfortable as before.
Yeah.
Except the amount of money you spend isn't going to buy coal or nuclear or something as much, or it's going to buy wind and solar energy, which are somewhat more expensive than coal and gas, not more expensive than nuclear, but and then you're spending the rest of that money on having a better house.
Yeah. Arjun Makajani is referring to his really landmark book that he authored in 2007, Carbon Free, Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for US Energy Policy, which you can download from IEER.org. And I really suggest that all of you listening to this program throughout America, Canada, and Australia download that book, read it. And it's like a Bible for the future. It really is. And when I read it, it's quite complex, but I felt like Archimedes, who, when he was sitting in his bath, realized that the amount of water he displaced equals the volume of his body, I think. And he leapt out of his bath and ran naked down the street. And I think I was reading it in the bath myself when I felt like Archimedes.
Now, you know we've put it up for free downloading thanks to a woman called Helen Caldicott. And, you know, you'll be happy to know that it's been downloaded more than 500,000 times.
There you go. And I also know the state of Utah, the state of Texas is using it as a handbook, a guidebook, and I know that Nancy Pelosi was interested in it, and I know that Massachusetts has been interested, and you know, the more it spreads, the better, Arjun. Now, I want to move on from here. I want you to, as a plasma physicist and a very brilliant physicist, tell us in a sort of brief, pricey way your summary of what's happening at Fukushima, number one, Fort Calhoun, number two.
Yeah, they're very different stories.
Yes.
Fort Calhoun, fortunately, is in a safe shutdown mode, and they have electricity, and their cooling systems are operating. Let's step back a little and figure out why emergency cooling is needed for a nuclear reactor. When a nuclear reactor is just a pressure cooker, with the heat source on the inside, and normally, you know, when you have a pressure cooker, you turn off the gas and you turn off the heat source. It'll cool down slowly. When you in the case of a nuclear reactor with a heat source on the inside, when you're generating electricity by splitting the uranium atoms and some plutonium atoms also, which build up inside the fuel, you get these radioactive fission products. And even when you turn off the reactor, when you turn off the chain reaction, these radioactive products, of course, have built up, and you can't turn them off. They will just decay at their natural decay rate. Sometimes it's in seconds, sometimes in hours, sometimes in days, years, tens of years, centuries, tens of thousands of years. So a certain amount of heat, quite a lot actually, is generated just from the fission products even after you've turned off the reactor. It's sort of like a fire you can't turn off.
Mm.
And so you've got to keep these fuel rods cool. And you keep them cool by circulating water, which carries away the heat.
Mm.
If you don't do that, which is what happened at Fukushima, the power lines were swept away by the tsunami or perhaps down by the earthquake or both, then the emergency generators came on, and then they failed very soon because of the tsunami. There was a battery that lasted for 4 hours, and that was very soon gone. The water stopped circulating in the reactor, and then it started boiling. And when the water starts boiling and the fuel rods become uncovered and contact the steam, there's a chemical reaction that happens between the fuel rod material, the zirconium, and the steam. And the zirconium becomes zirconium oxide from the oxygen and the H2O, and then you get free liberated hydrogen. That's where the hydrogen came from. And now you've got pressure building up from the steam inside, and the inside of the reactor is becoming hotter and hotter because this chemical reaction is liberating more heat. And if you don't vent the pressure, you're going to get an explosion, as you would with a pressure cooker, you know, with the heat underneath and no relief valve.
Mm.
So you have to have a relief valve, and there's a whole relief valve system. Eventually you have to vent this steam, and what happened in Fukushima is the hydrogen got into the reactor building and exploded and blew off the top of the reactor building in building one. In reactor number two, the cooling system itself, a part of the emergency sort of suppression pool, as it is called, around the reactor, there was apparently a hydrogen explosion there. In reactor three, also, there was a hydrogen explosion in the building that blew off a good bit of the building. And reactor four, which was shut, had a hydrogen explosion, I think it looks like, from the used fuel that was stored in the spent fuel pool. So
very hot used fuel.
Yeah, so you've got multiple sources of problems in these reactors, not just the reactors. You've got the used fuel that's stored in the reactor building at the top floor. And one of the horrible things that has happened from these explosions that's going to create a very big long-term problem is the explosions blew off the cranes. And now there is no equipment to handle this spent fuel or handle the highly radioactive melted fuel in the reactors. So now there's a real mess. You've got a highly radioactive site. You've got highly radioactive water leaking into the ocean. You've got surroundings with very difficult hot spots, and I believe that quite a lot of area over there is going to be uninhabitable. How much is hard to say. It will depend on, you know, partly on how hot it is and how what people are willing to tolerate, and how much cleanup they do. But a very big long-term problem is going to be it's going to be very difficult to decommission this site because the handling equipment has been blown off. And these spent fuel rods, which are near the top of the building, are so radioactive that approaching them is pretty lethal. And so rebuilding any structure and handling equipment, it's just going to be very, very hard. This is a tragedy, an accident of a type that had never been imagined. Seven major sources of radioactivity with blown-off reactor buildings, radioactivity emissions are still continuing.
Yes,
you know,
large
almost
ones.
4 months, well, 3.5 months into the accident.
Yes, and there still
a horrible,
could be
horrible things.
There still could be some major accidents in the future if, say, there's a large, very large aftershock and building four collapses, or say the melted fuel, you know, reacts with the concrete floor and there's a hydrogen or steam explosion. I mean, it's not finished, is it, Arjun?
It isn't finished, and the risks are there. And of course, there are other reactors along the same coast.
Yeah.
And this earthquake has rearranged not only the whole, you know, the main island of Japan has become rearranged. It was so powerful. It is also apparently, according to some seismologists, rearranged the seismicity of the area, making bigger earthquakes somewhat more probable. Mm. And I think Japan cannot tolerate another accident like this. They need to act with more alacrity than Germany, in my opinion. But
what, to
shut down all their
reactors?
Well, they need to go to a different electricity system.
Yeah.
Yes, I believe that.
Yep.
They can actually start by doing something really sensible that will save them money. They should shut down that sodium-cooled reactor they've been trying, that has operated for 1 hour in the last 16 years.
At Monju.
Trying to restart it at Monju.
Describe that one. Describe that one.
Well, there's a special reactor that physicists love because, in theory, it can make more fuel than it consumes. And it is cooled by sodium. Liquid sodium.
Liquid sodium.
Liquid sodium burns on contact with air and explodes on contact with water. And if you have a leak and you get burned sodium, you know, you get sodium oxide powder all over the place, and it's a real mess. It's very hard to clean up. It's not like taking a mop to water. So because it's powder that contaminates everything. And Monju had such a fire, and then it took them 15 years to even get it to restart for testing, and then a piece of equipment fell into the reactor.
That's
recently.
Right, 3.3 tons of equipment.
So they should save money by shutting that reactor down.
Yes!
They should shut down their reprocessing plant, which isn't producing anything. It's just undergoing testing at Rokkasho.
Yes.
And that's where they should start. They should reevaluate their energy strategy. And I've written about this in Japan since Fukushima. That you start there. Shut these two useless things that are just a money sinkhole. And sure, they may have to import some more liquid natural gas, you know, but they've already got the facilities. They can become leaders in renewable.
Sure.
Just imagine, we've already got California and we've got Germany.
Yeah.
If Japan were added to that,
three
highly technological societies, I'm just thinking out loud, actually, getting excited about
it. I know you are.
Going to carbon-free, nuclear-free in the next 25 years, I think just the economic force of that would transform the global energy.
Transform the world. I'm interviewing Dr. Arjun Makajani, a plasma physicist, the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. So, Arjun, what are the obstacles for Japan to proceed on such a path right now?
Well, you know, big institutions with vested interests don't seem to want to change even when disaster is not only staring them in the face, it has already happened.
Like Washington.
Yes, I mean, here it is staring us in the face. It hasn't happened. I mean, we've got a fiscal problem. We've got a climate problem.
Yeah.
And to some extent, we've had these disasters. I mean, no single flood or tornado or series of tornadoes can be linked to, you know, what I don't call it climate change.
Global warming.
I don't call it global warming.
What do you call it?
I call it severe climate disruption.
Yeah, fair enough.
That is what is going on.
Yes.
Now, we're having 100-year floods every 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, so...
It's crazy.
But, you know, you have to be able to see the handwriting on the wall, and I think the same thing is happening. You've got these entrenched institutions.
Yep.
I mean, the head of Tokyo Electric did not go to the power plant site for 1 month.
What? I didn't know that.
Yes, he did not
My
go for
God.
1 month.
He's got his head out of...
So this is kind of like a denial, you know.
Yep, and psychic numbing.
So the nuclear establishment is trying to regroup. Of course, you know, they're going to need their reactors for some time, just like Germany is going to need. We have 104 in the United States. Mm. You know, we can't switch them all off overnight. But, you know, we ought to think about doing like Germany and switching off some of the more vulnerable ones in places where we have surplus capacity. And doing emergency measures for efficiency and reducing electricity.
And maybe people might be able to turn their computers on and off and their DVDs and their blasted. You know, if you go around people's houses at night, there are lights blinking and clicking all over the place.
I've invited you to stay with me, but I don't know that I want you poking around. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you turn off all your things at night.
I actually turn off the surge protector switches. So when I'm not at the television, the whole apparatus is just
me
off.
Too.
Doesn't consume any stray power. Continuously.
Don't those
blinking... It's actually an enormous amount of energy.
Yeah, don't the set-top boxes and the blinking lights, etc., consume over 6% of the energy used in America just by doing nothing?
Of the electricity, yes.
Yeah.
I think there's a cultural aspect to this. That actually,
of entitlement.
There are some organizations and institutions that are beginning to attend to it. You know, 25 years ago, here in Montgomery County, we were debating, where I live in Maryland, we were debating recycling. And there were many in the county who said, oh, here, Americans, you know, we'll never learn how to separate newspaper from cans and plastic and from garbage and wet stuff from dry stuff. And I thought that this could happen. And we tried to prevent the county from building a huge, huge incinerator because I thought if people recycle, you won't have the trash to put in it.
Mm.
It'll be a big waste. And that's what happened. They built the big incinerator, and people are recycling. And I think the children were actually the motive forces in that.
Mm.
The young people caught on to recycling, and they actually forced us, old fogies, to be better. And, you know, in the trash scene today in Montgomery County, at least in my neighborhood, is drastically different than it was 25 years ago. I mean, the main weight from my house that goes into the garbage dump is kitty litter.
Why don't you use it in your garden to fertilize your plants?
Well, Kitty, we talk about that on another program.
All right, so let's...
my wife does compost, and we have a very big compost pile and improving soil, and she has a vegetable garden.
All right, let's get off the subject of kitty litter now. And there's another subject I want you to address, Arjun, and that's thorium reactors, because... Over and over again, people say, well, what about thorium? And India's got a lot of thorium, and India's moving to thorium reactors. Can you outline why they're so impractical and, in fact, damn dangerous, Arjun Makhijani?
Well, you know, there's no... So long as you have nuclear fission, you're going to have radioactivity. It's just a boiler. Everything else you have to have. You've got to have the generator. You've got to have the transmission. You've got to have the distribution. That's 80% of the investment. And now you've got a more expensive boiler. Uh, because nuclear fission inherently means fission products. It inherently means radioactivity. It inherently means control problems. Now, the Indians have been, they've known for a very long time that they have huge thorium resources. Now, thorium is not even a fuel. So the first thing, so you cannot sustain a chain reaction with thorium. It cannot be done. It's physically impossible. So you have to have a material with which you sustain a chain reaction. We had a small thorium reactor that was built here at Oak Ridge, operated for a few years in the 60s. What did it need? It needed either enriched uranium.
Uranium-235.
Yeah, U-235. Or plutonium to start the thing. Now, it was a small 7-megawatt thermal reactor that never generated a kilowatt hour of electricity, and its decommissioning estimate, last time I looked, was $130 million. You've got all this molten salt sitting in these cells. I don't know if it's been decommissioned yet, actually. And nobody knows what to do with it. You've got uranium-232. When you have thorium-232, you generate uranium-232 in the reactor. It has highly radioactive decay products. You have this kind of reactor is carbon moderated. You know, the worst accident, well, Fukushima now rivals Chernobyl in many ways. In some ways, Chernobyl was worse. In some ways, Fukushima is worse. But Chernobyl was a graphite moderated reactor. Many of these thorium reactor designs, this particular one that a lot of people like at Oak Ridge, is a graphite-moderated reactor. Liquid fuel reactors will have inline reprocessing, and then you have uranium-233 separation capabilities. People may say, well, the United States it's not going to be proliferation prone because the United States won't use the U-232. It's true. The United States already got plenty of surplus nuclear weapons materials that doesn't know what to do with. But certainly, so long as you're making uranium-233, the proliferation potential is going to be there. It's more difficult to make weapons when you separate out uranium-233 because also contaminated with uranium-232, more radioactivity problems. But do you think that a country that wants nuclear weapons or a terrorist group that wants nuclear weapons would care that much?
So,
I don't think so.
So you put thorium in a reactor, combine it with uranium-235 because thorium isn't naturally fissionable, but uranium-235 is. Then you convert the thorium to uranium-233.
Right.
Which can be used, A, for nuclear weapons, and then B, separated out and used in another reactor to make energy.
Well, it's used in the same reactor. As the reactor operates, you make uranium-233, and more and more of the energy is generated from uranium-233.
Oh.
And so this is supposed to be a molten salt breeder reactor where you might be able to make more fuel than you consume.
Oh.
But it breeds very slowly. The fuel manufacturing and processing and handling and decommissioning problems are going to be pretty significant. It's not that, you know, every reactor has its pluses and minuses. So molten salt reactors have some safety advantages compared to light water reactors. You don't have the zirconium fuel rods and you don't have the hydrogen generation potential. But at the same time, carbon moderation, and you get a lot of tritium production in the molten salt because the molten salt has lithium in it, and you bombard the lithium with neutrons, and you get tritium. You make the carbon quite radioactive. You get carbon-14 in the graphite block. It will be a giant disposal headache. You know, our nuclear waste repository here proposed Yucca Mountain, now canceled. Mm. One of the problems with Yucca Mountain that came out early on and people didn't pay attention was nuclear spent fuel has a small amount of carbon-14 in it from activation. And Yucca Mountain, being an oxidizing environment, would have converted that into carbon-14 dioxide and emitted it to the atmosphere slowly over thousands of years.
I didn't know that.
And it couldn't meet the carbon 14 standard, or may not have been able to meet, set by the EPA. And that was known early on. I was actually on the EPA committee that looked at that. And so instead of looking for a new site, they decided to change the standard. Now, can you imagine if we went to a carbon-moderated reactor, then you get these huge, huge graphite blocks that you have to dispose of that are now radioactive and combustible and pyrophoric. We have experience with this. The first big reactors that were built were carbon-moderated reactors at the University of Chicago and in Hanford, where they made the plutonium for the Nagasaki bomb. Now we've got those reactors have been shut down, and we've got these giant, giant graphite blocks that are radioactive, and if they are disposed off, as the Department of Energy is proposing, in the dumps, in the shallow land burial sites at Hanford, the water at Hanford will become polluted more than the drinking water standards by hundreds and hundreds of times. So you don't have an easy exit when you're dealing with radioactive materials in large amounts. No easy exit. And so my of course, there's no exit from the proliferation problem. You may have more or less of a proliferation problem, but you can't get rid of it.
Mm.
So my question, and then the third thing is, all new reactor designs will take time to build. They will take time to develop. They will take time to test and prove out. You have to have a completely new waste management and disposal strategy than what we have. And that will take some time to figure out. And so it'll be 20 years or 25 years by the time we figure it out and figure out the economics and the technical issues. By the time the global warming game will be over,
we'll be dead meat.
Yeah, so if we want to do something about severe climate disruption, and get rid of fossil fuels, which I believe we must do to nearly 100%, at least in the Western countries, and to a large extent also in the developing countries, the only way to do it that is practical and sensible and that is available now is efficiency. That's the foundation. And renewable energy, mainly wind and solar energy. There are other renewable energy, tidal energy, and wave energy, and so on.
How can we stop people leaving their lights on all night, Arjun, and lighting up their gardens? I mean, I look at this and I think, what the hell do these people think they're up to?
Well, you know, one thing that I defer with you on, Helen, is we can't get them to change by pointing out that they're doing something bad and leaving it at that, because you know it's a cultural change requires a different kind of motive force.
But what about the future for their children? Don't they love their children?
Of course, they love their children. You know, but they don't think of it in the. They haven't thought about it as much as you have.
Well, that's
they're not focused on it. They haven't spent their lives as you have. And bless you, you know you. The more I go around and I speak, I know that you have inspired more people around, especially around nuclear disarmament, but also around energy, to think about it. And I know you inspired this whole clothespin project that our young friend did in New Hampshire, you know, to not dry clothes. What was it called? Now I'm blanking.
Operation Laundry List.
Laundry List, yes.
Hang your clothes outside and let the nuclear reactor in the sky dry
them.
Doing
all of that is a very admirable thing, but it requires a cultural change, and I can't say I have a good fix on that. You know, I did the first energy efficiency calculations for the U.S. economy way back in 1970-71, and I gave some talks about it then, and I brought up this issue of lighting the daylight. One of the buildings in Berkeley had a beautiful, beautiful, at UC Berkeley, a beautiful, beautiful skylight, also had, you know, dozens and dozens of bulbs that were lighting up the daylight. And when I pointed this out, they said, well, you're attacking the American way of life.
Oh, my God, Arjun.
How can it be part of a way of life to light up the daylight? What good is it doing? Well, you know, President Nixon, I understand, rest his soul, you know, he liked to make the White House really cold in the winter, in the summer, so he could have a fire and be comfortable. It's that kind of idea, you know, it's in a different place than logic. It's
in the gut. It's an emotion. It's in the midbrain. And that's what we, as scientists, Arjun, you and I, have to appeal to the midbrain and the emotions. Otherwise, people are not going to change. And what I do when I lecture is give lots and lots and lots and lots of facts so people can relax and think, okay, she knows what she's talking about. Then I go for their gut and then I go for their emotions. And if I can find a baby in the room, I'll hold the baby up, and that really gets them. So we've got to be able to appeal to their humanity.
I have to get more babies coming to
you
my
do,
car.
You do. I mean, you need to advertise for babies, Arjun. Listen, my love, we've run out of time, unfortunately, just when we're really starting to get stuck into it. So
well, invite me again. We'll continue.
I will. There's so much to talk about. Arjun, it's been absolutely lovely to talk to you, and we will continue the conversation in the near future.
Yeah, I love talking to you because talking to you in public like this on the radio is a lot like talking to you in private.
Except we don't have any Indian food to eat together, Arjun, or Annie's tartan.
You have to come visit us and we'll have Indian food.
I will. Arjun married this lovely French woman called Annie, and so you can have wonderful Indian food at their place, or wonderful French food. So
yes, especially, and many other kinds besides.
That's right. Anyway, thank you, Arjun, once again. Okay.
Thank you, Helen.
Bye-bye. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Dr. Arjun Makhijani, the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. If you would like to support this program, and I know some of you would, there is a Donate Now button on our webpage, ifyoulovethisplanet.org. At the moment, we are needing to raise money, I hate to say this, but we are, to pay our wonderful producers, and so to keep the show on the road, and I'm really serious, we do need to raise money right now. So if any of you feel like being generous, feel the program is worthwhile, feel it's educational, I'd be so grateful if you would go to the donate button now and give us some money. Money makes the world go round. Thanks for listening today. We'll be back with you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.